Welcome to KUOW Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this week's episode, in 1777, Marie-Joseph Paul-Yves Roche Gilbert Dumotier de Lafayette was a French aristocrat looking for military glory. Since the French weren't at war, the 19-year-old crossed the Atlantic to join George Washington and other American revolutionaries in their fight with the British. That's where Sarah Vowell comes in. In her new book, Lafayette in the Somewhat United States, Vowell again examines aspects of American history from angles most of us would never consider. Lafayette turns out to be a story of friendship on many levels, during the Revolution and 50 years later when the general returned to America to great acclaim. Sarah Vowell is a New York Times best-selling author. Her books include Unfamiliar Fishes, The Wordy Shipmates, and Assassination Vacation. She was a contributing editor for This American Life from 1996 to 2008. Her appearance at the Neptune Theater on October 28, 2015 was hosted by Seattle Theater Group and the Elliott Bay Book Company. The Strangers editor-in-chief Christopher Frizzell joined Vowell on stage in conversation. Thanks to Anna Tadashev for our recording.
Welcome to the Neptune. My name is Christopher. I'm the editor-in-chief of The Stranger, and we are so lucky to be here tonight with one of the funniest writers in the country. It's so cold and wet outside, I couldn't help but think on my way over, gosh, I wish I'd dressed warmer. And then the moment I thought that, I had this second thought, which was, oh, come on, stop complaining. We're here to talk with Sarah Vowell about the American Revolution, and one of the scenes in the American Revolution, of course, is Valley Forge. And just to refresh your memory, George Washington is with his soldiers. They are undersupplied, underfed, underclothed, so much so that they don't even have shoes, and they're bleeding all over the frozen ground and leading these bloody footprints. And not just that, but their legs are getting all black from frostbite, and their legs and feet have to get amputated. Anyway, the weather's fine, and it's so nice to be here with all of you. Does everyone have shoes? Okay, good. Then we're doing okay. We've come a long way. When I first picked up Sarah's book, Lafayette in the Somewhat United States, the first thing I did was laugh at the somewhat, because it's hilarious. She also calls it the ironically named United States. The second thing I did was I said, Lafayette, Lafayette, who's Lafayette? I knew I should know. I've heard the name a million times. Plenty of things are named after him. But I couldn't connect it with a face or with a life or with a history. So thank God for this book. Sarah writes in the book, I do not think there can ever be enough books about anything. And I say that knowing that some of them are going to be about Pilates. Now that I've read the book, I can tell you confidently that Lafayette was a 19-year-old French wealthy guy who got on a boat and skipped out on his pregnant wife to volunteer for the American Revolution and also convinced Louis XVI to give us a bunch of money that ended up hurting France in the long run and leading to their revolution and costing Louis XVI his head. But we won our war. I'm getting ahead of ourselves. We'll get to all that. There will be a Q&A after we have a conversation on stage. My questions are going to be all about the book. And while we're up here, give some thought to what questions you would like to ask. Particularly of interest to Sarah, I'm sure, would be follow-up questions about things she's talked about, or other questions about the book, or questions about books generally. We were just backstage talking about Star Wars, and I revealed my total ignorance of Star Wars, and she was sort of aghast, like you are. So the more we stick to books, the happier I am. Without further ado, Sarah Vowell is the New York Times best-selling author of nonfiction books on American history and culture, including Unfamiliar Fishes, The Wordy Shipmates, Assassination Vacation, The Partly Cloudy Patriot, Take the Cannoli, and Radio On. She was a contributing editor for This American Life, as well as one of the original contributors to McSweeney's. She has also been a columnist for Salon, Time, San Francisco Weekly, and the opinion page of the New York Times. Her writing has also appeared multiple times in The Stranger. She has made numerous appearances on The Late Show with David Letterman, Late Night with Conan O'Brien, and The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. Please put your hands together for Sarah Vowell.
Hello. What an upbeat introduction.
Was it the Valley Forge part?
But that's just a rule in comedy to always start with Valley Forge.
Won't you read to us a little bit and then we can get going?
Read. Okay. I'll read a little bit. So for this section, I guess the only thing you need to know is some of the book takes place 50 years-ish after the Revolution, when the elderly Lafayette returns to the United States as a hero, and it's a big mania. There's Lafayette mania, and more than half the population of New York City meets his ship when he arrives, and it's this 13-month-long party when the American people embrace him as one. Nowadays, Lafayette is a place, not a person. Lafayette is a boulevard in Phoenix, a Pennsylvania college, and a bridge across the Mississippi in St. Paul. It's the Alabama birthplace of boxer Joe Louis and three separate towns in Wisconsin. Four, if Fayette counts. If so, it is also Fayette County, which the chicken ranch, better known as the best little whorehouse in Texas, put on the map. It is, without question, Lafayette, Indiana, where the founders of both C-SPAN and Guns N' Roses were born. When I bumped into an old neighbor whilst visiting my Montana hometown, she asked me what I was working on, and I answered, a book about Lafayette. So she inquired if I would be spending a lot of time in Louisiana. I was confused, wondering if she forgot that Thomas Jefferson decided against his initial impulse of appointing Lafayette as the former French colony's first governor after the Louisiana Purchase. And then I realized that the city of Lafayette, Louisiana, must be her go-to Lafayette-labeled noun, even though from Montana, it's actually a closer drive to Lafayette, Utah, not to mention the ones in Oregon, California, Kansas, and Colorado. So I explained that I meant Lafayette, the French teenager who crossed the Atlantic on his own dime to volunteer to fight with George Washington in the Revolutionary War. Therefore, I said I was more likely to visit Pennsylvania, where he got shot. She nevertheless professed her fondness for Zydeco. Now, this encounter aroused such indignation in my breast that I moralized upon the instability of human glory and the evanescence of many other things. No, wait, that's what Herman Melville did in 1870 when a random stranger in a cigar store had never heard of his Revolutionary War hero grandfather. When I found out my old neighbor had never heard of my Revolutionary War hero protagonist, I went and got a taco with my sister. Still, it does seem eerie how one day in 1824, two-thirds of the population of New York City was lining up to wave hello to Lafayette, and 19 decades go by, and all that's left of his memory is the name of a Cajun college town. Thanks to the nationwide euphoria over the elderly Lafayette's return tour of the United States, countless American streets, parks, cities, counties, schools, warships, horses, and babies bear his name. The long list includes Scientology founder Lafayette Ronald L. Ron Hubbard and my Arkansas-born great-great-uncle Lafayette Hines, who went by Fate for short. And the most meaningful namesake by far is Lafayette Square across the street from the White House, also known as Lafayette Park. This is the nation's capital of protest, the place where we the people gather to yell at our presidents. In each corner of this seven-acre park stands a statue of four of the most revered European officers who served in the Revolutionary War: Lafayette, Rochambeau, Steuben, and Thaddeus Kosciuszko, the Polish engineer whose defensive works contributed to the Continental Army's victory at Saratoga. Or, as one of the anti-nuclear protesters who have kept up a continual peace vigil in the park since 1981 referred to the warrior statues when I chatted with her the last time I visited the park, goons with guns. Hippies. While I am baffled by the off-topic inclusion of an equestrian statue of President Andrew Jackson lording over the center of a square honoring the contributions of foreign fighters, I do approve of the bronze Jackson's gesture of tipping his hat, evoking Walt Whitman's explanation for the genius of the American people as the president's taking off his hat to them and not they to him.
Walt Whitman.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you. It goes on from there to talk about, you know, suffragists.
They had the right idea, I think.
Yeah.
He's a 19-year-old rich guy. He's dancing with Marie Antoinette.
Not well. He stepped on her toes. He laughed at him.
Yeah, is there more to that story? So he steps on her toes and she laughs at him. Okay.
Yeah.
What more need be said?
I mean, he left France soon thereafter. I don't know if it had anything to do with that.
And he left his pregnant wife there.
He didn't know the secret of dancing, which is always do the pogo, you know.
Trying to recreate what's happening in his mind. What's going on? He has a pregnant wife. He's famous in France. He's got lots of money. Why would he get on a ship and go to a country with a crust punk like George Washington?
Well, there are a few reasons. I don't know what a crust punk is, but
it's a local word for someone who walks around grumpily, not showering.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Like from Bellingham?
Yeah, no. Exactly. You nailed it.
So he was an orphan, and one of the reasons he was an orphan was that the British army had killed his soldier father in the previous war, which was, they call it the Seven Years' War, and we call it the French and Indian War. And so he had kind of a grudge against the British for that. And they killed his dad. And then also, he really did, like so many Frenchmen of that era, become entranced with Enlightenment ideas about liberty and justice, and he thought that's what the American rebels were fighting for, and so that appealed to the idealist in him. And then also, I mean, he was a 19-year-old boy, and he was out for adventure. And then, I mean, part of that was that because he came from a military family, and his ancestors were soldiers going back to the Crusades. One of his ancestors fought with Joan of Arc. He wanted glory on the battlefield. And France was at peace, so, you know, he had to go where the battles were.
Also, he probably just wanted to leave home, right? He wanted to see the world.
Yeah, I mean, that's the first time I left. Well, I think I'd been to Canada, but that was, you know, I was 19 and I went on my European, you know, adventure. It seems like about the right age. I mean, also, he was an orphan, but he had married into this very fancy military family, and his in-laws were incredibly controlling, and I think he wanted to get away from them. I mean, his father-in-law had tried to get him a job with the king's brother, a really boring Versailles court job, and Lafayette wanted to be a soldier, and so he insulted the king's brother to get out of it and said, he was also an only child, he said, I did not hesitate to be disagreeable to preserve my independence.
Spoken like an only child.
Very much so.
You write in the book that one of the ideas for starting it came about in the house where Herman Melville wrote Moby Dick. Tell us what visiting that house was like, because Moby Dick obviously is a wonderful book that a lot of people like, but also how does it lead to Lafayette?
Well, I wanted to see that house because I love my Moby Dick, and supposedly there's the, you know, hill outside the window that supposedly looked like a whale, you know?
I didn't know
anybody?
That.
Anybody? No one's going to see whale hills? and while I was there, they had on display this dress that his wife wore as a baby to be presented to Lafayette. And, you know, it was kind of enshrined as this relic, this holy relic of what she was wearing the day that, you know, the hero of two worlds came to I think, Boston it was. And that was what kind of set me off on researching that return trip, which was kind of my entry into his story.
And explain Melville's connection to Lafayette.
There is one. I mean, that Revolutionary War soldier grandfather of him, Colonel Gansevoort, he had met Lafayette during the war, and then on that return trip, Lafayette was going through Albany, and Colonel Gansevoort was dead by then, but Lafayette stopped and paid his respects to Gansevoort's widow, and there was a portrait of Gansevoort in the house, and Lafayette, you know, admired the portrait, and then when Lafayette leaves, Gansevoort's son, Herman Melville's uncle, writes to Herman Melville and his brother about this miraculous visit, and every time Melville and his brother would go visit his grandmother, they would stand where Lafayette had stood. So there's a real kind of almost religious overtones. I mean, it was different for different families. One time I was at the Seward House, also upstate New York, and because I had written about Secretary of State Seward in my assassination book, because he was stabbed. And I was talking about Lafayette, and I remember the director said, oh, there's a letter that Lafayette wrote to Seward. He stayed here. And the museum tracked down one of Seward's descendants, who was an older gentleman, and they talked this guy into driving this letter, you know, to my reading last night so I could see the letter from Lafayette. And it was Lafayette had left his nightgown behind, you know, in the house. And either, I can't remember if he was thanking them for returning it or he wanted it back, I don't know, but
riveting
it wasn't all, you know, it wasn't all spiritual. But I'm on the road. I mean, like, your pajamas are an important connection to a sense of security and home. So I get it. I get it.
Speaking of spiritual, or quote-unquote spiritual, go back to the L. Ron Hubbard detail. The L stands for Lafayette?
Yes. I mean, technically, I'm pretty sure. I'm not positive. I think Lafayette Ronald Hubbard, he was named for his grandfather, whose name was Lafayette, and he was named for Lafayette, I think.
But still,
it's in there.
Wow. You write that the quintessential experience of living in the United States is constantly worrying whether the country is about to fall apart. You also write that it's a place...
I think we can all agree, or can we?
You also write it's a place where we can never agree on anything except the bipartisan consensus on barbecue and Meryl Streep.
I think we also all hate our cable providers.
True that.
You know. But I think we also all love Willie Nelson.
How is the U.S. doing compared to 10 years ago, compared to 200 years ago, vis-a-vis constantly falling apart?
I think it's about the same. I mean, really, I think probably the worst time was the Civil War, when we were literally killing each other. But I mean, I talk about the first thing that happened in the first Continental Congress was one delegate had a motion to open with a prayer. And the second thing that happened was that two Episcopalians stood up and said, I'm paraphrasing here, but basically, no way, I'm not praying with all you weirdos. We're too many religions, Baptists and Congregationalists and Quakers. And, that's the moment when maybe they should have called it quits and gone home. And we could all be, 50 different countries, which maybe we should be, I don't know. And as when Lafayette arrives, he's an idealistic teenager, and he thinks he's coming over to help the Americans against the British. But then he gets here, and the Americans are pretty much in chaos the entire time, and some of them are loyal to the British crown, and then the Continental Army and the Continental Congress can't coordinate, and there's a conspiracy in the Congress and the Army to fire George Washington. And, one of the congressmen at the time talks about how the Congress can't get anything done. All they do is bicker. I think he says, we murder time. And I could relate to that, And he writes to George Washington this letter from across the camp at Valley Forge saying he thinks America can defend herself. Basically, he says, I think you could fight the British if you would just stop fighting with each other. And Washington agrees and talks about the fatal tendency of disunion. And, fast forward to when I was researching the book, and when I had planned to go to battlefields and historic sites, having to do with Lafayette's time in the Revolutionary War, it coincided with the government shutdown in 2013. So a lot of those places were closed. So that, I don't know if Washington's right. I don't know if it's a fatal tendency of disunion. It's a definite tendency of disunion. But like that part I just read about Lafayette Park, and that's sort of toward the end of the book, the reason I end there is because I think we beat ourselves up for our tendency toward disunion, and we complain about how divided we are as a people. And obviously it's aggravating and makes the government inefficient, even though the government was designed to be inefficient. I think we take that for granted. Besides the fact that we're allowed to protest our government from Lafayette Park, people from other countries who don't have that right, when their heads of state come to meet with our president, people from other countries can protest their own leaders from Lafayette Square. And if they did that back home, they would be thrown in jail or worse, So ultimately, as I was working on the book, and I guess I had some extra time to think about this when, Independence Hall was closed down. But I basically have come to see it as more or less a good thing, our disunion, because it's because we have the right to say what we think, believe what we want, get on each other's nerves.
One fun thing about being here tonight is that we're skipping the Republican debate.
Oh, yeah. We are. This is terrible citizenship, I'm sure.
Do you watch that stuff?
I do. At this stage, it's not
pure entertainment?
I wouldn't call it entertaining. If, let's say, on the off chance you care about the country, sometimes.
But you're mostly focused on the past because you don't want to think about the future, or you just...
That sounded like an accusation,
I'm
Christopher.
Sorry.
What are you focused on?
Well, guilty.
Here's what Christopher, this is one of the, I've known Christopher a long time, but we don't know each other well. But the one thing I do know is that you organize these events where people go to a public place and they read books together. Not the same book. They go to a bar. They all have their own books, and they sit side by side reading.
That's right, Sarah.
And so, what?
It's the most Seattle party of all time. You're not allowed to make small talk.
So I don't know.
You want to make small talk.
Yeah. So there's no small talk. Is there talk?
No. There's a piano playing, and you don't want to talk
piano?
Over the guy. I mean, there's a man playing the piano. It doesn't play itself. Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah.
Huh. Has anyone ever read one of my books in this?
I'm sure.
I don't think so. I don't think my people are joiners. I mean, you understand that books are an anti-social medium, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like,
I did see someone reading Moby Dick there once.
You did?
Yeah.
And no one ever, like, is moved to say, get this, you guys, and, like, read a passage or...
They are sometimes, and it's cute. They kind of erupt.
Uh-huh, really?
It's really cute,
yeah. All right.
But then they settle down.
Okay.
Yeah. You should come sometime.
I would like to see it.
Does see mean judge?
Mm-hmm.
Something I love about what you do...
I mean, like, it's interesting because one of the things I did for research... I don't know if it's interesting. One of the things I did for research was... It reminds me of going to a Quaker meeting because I had to deal with the Quakers a little bit in this.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know if you've ever been to a Quaker meeting. Generally, no one says anything. They're allowed to if they have something to say, but mostly people sit together in silence. And I went to this one in Philadelphia, and I was in there for 2 hours. That's what I thought. I came out and I'd only lasted 14 minutes. But coming from a radio background, it was basically like just room tone. You know, room tone is what you, it's just the sound of the room and you have to record that for editing. And it's just people sitting in a room not making any noise or trying not to. And, it was awkward, and I kept, like, people kept making awkward eye contact. Does that happen at your things?
Not really. People kind of stare in the middle distance and listen to the music.
Uh-huh. And then people were kind of, like, someone would sneeze, and it would be like a bomb went off, you know? And I was kind of thinking, like, it would be nice if we had something to look at, and then it would be nice if there was something to drown out all this, like, coughing.
Uh-huh.
And then I left because I was like, yeah, it's the movies, you know? But then I met this Quaker woman, and she told me that, I asked her about it, and she said she thought of it as not the absence of talking, but the presence of God. I know.
Sounds like L. Ron Hubbard would say.
Do you? Yeah.
Something you do is that I love is you take this very complicated, arcane stuff and you blend it into a kind of very contemporary, casual language. Do people ever say, why are you doing that? Why do you write like that? Why be so casual? Why not sound more serious?
Why not sound more serious?
Yeah.
I mean, it's fairly serious, isn't it?
The Valley Forge? Shoeless blood scene?
Yeah. I mean, it's serious when things are serious.
Yeah.
I mean, it's fun. I mean, obviously, I get asked that question. I think I call the form of that question, you X, but you also Y. and sort of like, what? Well, here's this jokey bit about how much your driver bugs you. And then here's this part where 2,000 people die of exposure and disease. And, like, there are so many different tones. And I always want to say, like, have you ever been alive for 12 hours? Like, sometimes we joke around. And then other times we bury our dead, you know? Like... So, I'm a person, and sometimes I'm serious, and sometimes I'm not. And the story, like, each segment of the story kind of just has its own needs, you know? Like, each part of the story needs to be told in its own way. And it's kind of why I never really thought about it before, but I don't have chapters, because that makes it sound like we're going to talk about this one thing, and then we're going to be done with that, and then we're going to move on to this other thing. And all the chapters are about the same length for some reason, which doesn't ever make sense to me, you know, because different things are longer and shorter. I don't know. So, there are mood swings because there are mood swings, you know.
Because life.
I mean, I understand, I guess, more traditional kinds of writing where things are more monotone, I guess. But, I mean, some of this stuff is, I mean, I think some of the changes in tone have to do with some of the parts of the story take place now, where it's me going to these places interacting with locals. And generally that's more lighthearted, because I think, you know, when people encounter one another, they generally keep it light, you know? And, I mean, it's funny, like, I really don't think about these things. I just, when I'm writing, I go from section to section. I don't really write from section to section. I almost write from transition to transition. And I'm just in whatever's happening, that's what's happening. So, you know, if my nephew is making fun of me, that's what's happening. But then I can use that to pivot and talk about Hannah Arendt.
Right.
And I do.
Right.
Because, you know, that's the next thing that's happening. And the thing he's joking about actually speaks to what Hannah Arendt wrote about in On Revolution, you know?
One of my favorite examples of a
Why do you
like
have
this?
To box me in, Christopher? Like,
gosh, you're the one literally, who suddenly banality
literally,
of evil.
I literally met, this is a person who came to one of the readings once, and he came up to get his book signed, and he said, you know what I hate about you, which is always a great opener, is like, I like to put people in little boxes, and then based on what my mood is, you know, like, some people are in the funny box and some people are in the drama box or whatever, and then based on what mood I'm in, then I can pick, you know, I can, if I'm in a good mood, then I go to the comedy box, or if I need to be in a good mood, that's where I go, or if I'm feeling serious, then I go to the drama box. And I don't like how many boxes you need or whatever. And I am sorry, I cannot make myself smaller to fit into your free time, you know.
Well, I love it. I'm a person who, I was telling you backstage, I've been writing a lot about Virginia Woolf lately, and I want to write about her in a way that my surfer cousins would understand, just as much as a Virginia Woolf scholar would understand. So I love a sentence
Are
like,
your surfer cousins like, don't do us any favors?
Yes. This is a sentence of yours. I'm going to read it to you.
Oh.
Whatever their shortcomings, it's a dinner scene. Whatever their shortcomings, the French could always be counted on to roast the hell out of a chicken. That's you talking about Americans giving the French such a hard time over and over for many years. For all that the French can be teased, we owe them a heck of a lot, according to this book.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the subplots in the book is about how the American rebels could not have won their war without help from the French government, without gunpowder and ultimately the French army and navy. And but the Franco-American alliance, it has its ups and downs. And the first, I mean, while it ends in this, you know, glorious Franco-American victory at Yorktown, and with Cornwallis surrendering to the Americans and the French, there are some hiccups along the way. And at the beginning, after the first joint operation after the Treaty of Alliance is signed, this fleet comes over from France, and they're supposed to help the New England militias get the British out of Newport, Rhode Island. And they sail toward Newport, and on their way, there's this big storm, and their ships are just shattered by it. And finally, they're blown out to sea. And the general who's in charge of the army and militias from New England who have gathered in Rhode Island, and their numbers have swelled because the French are going to be there, and everyone hears, oh, this is a slam dunk. So everyone comes to participate, including people like John Hancock and Paul Revere. Everyone from, I think Revere says everyone from Boston is there. And they're just ready to, like, defeat the British and then go home. But then the French, their ships are really damaged, and so they bail. And they go back to Boston to get their ships repaired, and everyone in New England is like, what the hell, you know? And they just turn on the French. And in Boston, when the French fleet arrive in Boston for repairs, there are riots, and, you know, one French officer who tries to calm things down, they club him to death. And there are these ancient animosities between Britain and France. And even though the French are now the Americans' allies, the Americans have only been not British for like 3 years. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, they all kind of, several of them mention their ancient prejudices. And it sort of stretches back to the Norman invasion in 1066. So there are like hundreds and hundreds of years of hating the French, and now they're suddenly supposed to be their buddies. And it was a big, that first one was a big miss. And, I mean, that poor French soldier who died, the other thing is, I mean, going back to the question of whether our country should ever have been a country, is that in Boston, which was still Puritan Boston, you know, it's still, like, it's not the 19th century and the potato famine when Boston becomes Catholic because of all the Irish immigrants because of the potato famine. So at that time in the 1770s, it's illegal to be Catholic in Boston, and they have to bury this French guy, and he has a Catholic corpse, and they don't know what to do because they can't give him a Catholic burial, but they did just murder their ally, so things are touchy. And the compromise they come up with is they're going to bury him in the King's Chapel burying ground where all the Puritan fathers are buried, but they do it in the middle of the night. And eventually things pick up from there, but it's really tricky. And not just because of that animosity. Like, I mean, to me, one of the most fascinating scenes to think about is, so when the French government decides, okay, they sign the Treaty of Alliance and the Treaty of Amity and Commerce, and, you know, when the news hits Valley Forge, all those guys, they yell, long live the King of France. It's a really big deal. And Ben Franklin, who has been working toward this in Paris, he's called to Versailles to meet with Louis XVI to, you know, acknowledge and celebrate their alliance, and they're alone. And Louis says he hopes this goes well or something. And just thinking about, like, yeah, he hopes, because neither one of them know how this is going to turn out. And how he's 23, Louis XVI, he's this absolute monarch, and he's just, you know, thrown in with this son of a Boston soap maker.
This who's anti-monarchy.
Yeah. And they're like, well, I hope this works out. Because it's not like they can look up, like, what happened, you know, the last time this happened, because it's totally new.
You go to Colonial Williamsburg, and you mm-hmm. see an actor playing George Washington, and you talk about the things that he's saying are kind of surprising to the tourists that you're with. And there's a line about how half of the white guys, their jaws are hanging open based on what George Washington is telling
yeah,
them.
Yeah, because Colonial Williamsburg is in Virginia, which is in the South. And the Washington reenactor, we're having a Q&A with him. And it's basically 1781, right before Yorktown. And he's, as my nephew says, super irritated, you know, because he's had to be at war for, he's been at war for the last, well, he's been for the last 5 years. There's just never enough supplies or help or anything. And he's also irritated because the Continental Army is trying to defend Virginia, and Virginia is not helping them. And then he goes off on this rant about what's, like, the problem with states' rights and how, like, these states just, they're just too obsessed with their own, they're just not helping out. They're not participating in the greater good, and there needs to be more taxes. So George Washington is denouncing states' rights and talking about how, like, we need to raise taxes, and all of these, maybe Southern gentlemen who are there to enjoy a nice afternoon with George Washington are getting upset hearing about this because, obviously, these are two of the issues that divide us, you know, states' rights and taxes. But from George Washington's point of view, he thinks, and correctly, if the Continental Congress were allowed to levy taxes, then he could have given his men, like, food and stuff.
Shoes.
Yeah. Shoes.
If the Virginians weren't being so Virginian about it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if this would, like, ruin people's 4th of July, but whenever we talk about our revolution and how we won the war, a lot of the backstory of what's going on in the actual day-to-day slog of the war is the American people not really helping out their army as much as they could. So
speaking of Valley Forge, can you just...
Wow, you just keep coming back to Valley Forge.
I can't stop thinking about it. How many people? How much suffering was happening? What put us there?
2,000 of them died there. I mean, they arrived right before Christmas, and they have to start building their own shelter. There isn't enough food. Very little water. Disease is rampant. Dysentery. Malnutrition, exposure, and, you know, Washington is kind of paralyzed. I mean, there's nothing he can really do. And then spring comes, and he assigns, he starts sending out foraging party, and they start feeding everyone. And then, luckily, one of these foreigners who come over and help is this German, Friedrich von Steuben, who is a veteran of the Prussian army, which was basically the best-trained army in the world. I was just thinking, no offense, Japan. And anyway, he comes over and he trains the army in this insanely short amount of time. And, you know, they haven't really, like, he talks about things like they don't know what to do with their bayonets. They just use their bayonets to grill meat with. And he trains them. It's like a remarkable transformation. And then the news comes to Valley Forge that the French have signed the Treaty of Alliance, and they march out of there jubilant and, prepared, the ones who can march out of there.
You also mentioned, but don't go into it, I wonder if there's any more detail, the first gay soldier to get kicked out was kicked out at Valley Forge by George Washington. Is that sort of true?
Yeah, the first... He was kicked out for sodomy. He was literally drummed out of the camp with a drum.
Is that like they push you and then the drums follow you and they play music as you leave? What does that mean?
I think so, yeah. Huh.
That's rough. Speaking of rough, you also talk about New York, Manhattan, the prisons there with the prisoners of war. Mm-hmm. More people dying there than all of the rest of the revolution combined. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's something
you're
like
really
many,
honing
many,
in
many...
on all the like real grim bits here, but yeah,
I can't help it.
I mean, the thing about like New York is kind of it's always in the back of George Washington's mind because in 1776 he loses it. It's just a debacle, and the British take over control of New York City, in 1776, and they don't march out of there until 1783. And for George Washington, are you ready for a Moby Dick reference?
Oh, yeah.
New York is his white whale.
Oh.
And he wants to get it back because it's embarrassing. I mean, when they're just fleeing and, you know, and retreating from Kips Bay in Manhattan, which most people in Manhattan only go to because there's a movie theater there. It's like a movie theater like in America, you know, like a multiplex. But around that, around where that movie theater was, George Washington is so despondent at the like willy-nilly retreat of his newbie soldiers that he throws up his hands and says, "Are these the men with which I am to defend America?" And
sounds like Ahab on the deck of the
ship. Yeah. And so the whole war, he's just obsessed with getting it back, and he never does. He keeps, every time a new crop of Frenchmen come over, he always has these plans of we're gonna like a joint op to take back Manhattan, and the French never come through. And it would have been another debacle if they had tried, but he's just so wounded, and he's just so wounded by the fact that New York City becomes the British base of operations for the next 7 years, and that's where they keep all the American prisoners of war in these rotting prison ships that are anchored in the East River. And
you're the one writing about them licking the lice off their hands just to get their protein intake.
Yeah, it was bad. It was bad. And 11,000 of them died, and which is more than died in all the battles. And it was, the whole thing was just a black mark. And even by the, like, right before Yorktown, Washington still wants Rochambeau, the French general, he wants Rochambeau to take back New York. And Rochambeau and the French Admiral de Grasse, They choose Virginia to make their stand, and rightly so. It succeeded. And Washington, I mean, talk about, like, I lived on Union Square in New York for about 10 years, and there's a statue of Lafayette in the square, and then there's the statue of George Washington, and it's depicting the day he comes back into New York at the end of the war after the peace treaty has been signed in Paris, and the last Brits have finally left, and he rides his horse into Manhattan, and it was called Evacuation Day. And I think whoever put that statue up, it's sort of like, yay, New York was free. But I think for Washington, if he knew that was the statue commemorating that day where his dream never came true, and he could only ride his horse into town once the final ships had pulled out of New York Harbor, it's sort of a very bittersweet victory.
It would be like putting a tattoo of Ahab on the white whale.
Would it, Christopher?
Well, you're the one who started the metaphor. Okay, happier story. What about the playwright, the Barber of Seville playwright?
Oh, yes.
That funny duck. Can
the
you tell
playwright.
Us about him?
The playwright. Yeah, okay, so before the official French Treaty of Alliance, the French were helping the Americans kind of on the sly. I mean, they were trying to help the Americans without the British finding out because they really didn't have the money or the wherewithal to go to war with Great Britain again so soon after the Seven Years' War. And so the person who was the point man for the covert arms dealer who was supposed to supply the American rebels with supplies like tents and gunpowder and cannons and things was the playwright Beaumarchais, who wrote The Barber of Seville and The Marriage of Figaro. And he was basically the greatest playwright of his age in France. And he's the guy who's in charge of gun running.
He was also a spy, yeah.
Yeah, he was a spy before that. There's a whole backstory there. But so he's successful, the French government and the Spanish government, because the Spanish king is the cousin of Louis XVI. They give him all this money to buy all these supplies. And he goes to the port city of Le Havre, and he's supposed to supervise all this stuff being loaded onto ships. Meanwhile, he gets to town, and it turns out that the local community theater group is putting on one of his plays. And they're putting on The Barber of Seville. And he sees the production, is not happy with it. He's in town in an assumed name because it's, you know, secret. And then he sees his play and he's like, no, 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 no. And he forces the local theater troupe. He starts running rehearsals every day with them. And so he's running back and forth from the dock to the theater. And obviously the British find out because, you know, he's Beaumarchais. And it's just a big farce. Ultimately, most of his supplies did get through. And the British did find out about it. But they staved off war between France and Britain for a little while. But then I was mentioning, I have one of my best friends as a playwright, and I was mentioning how ridiculous all of this sounded to him, and all my playwright friend said was, how did that production of Barber of Seville turn out once he tinkered with it, you know?
The important questions.
Yeah, I know.
I'm sure it was great. So Lafayette.
I mean, one more thing though about like the playwright doing that, or you know, von Steuben, the German who retrains the army. Like one of the more eerie parts of the story I find is how all of the people who turned out to be the man for the job sound like they're not the man for the job on paper. You know, like even George Washington, when there was that conspiracy to get him fired, there were these candidates with a lot of experience. And like, you know, one of them had experience had from the British Army before the Revolution. And he just thought, of course, I'm going to be made commander in chief. Charles Lee was his name. And then there was another one, Horatio Gates, and then there was this. There were a few who had a lot more experience than Washington, and they're like, "You should give me the job. Look how good I look on paper." And Washington turned out to be the guy who could hold it up together all those years. And then, I mean, Steuben, who retrains the army, the only English words he knows are swear words. He's escaped Europe because there are rumors that he's gay and he can't get a military job on the continent, so he's kind of he's just out of a job and he's out of money, and he comes to America hoping to get hired. And then the Continental Congress kind of hires him on a whim, and he turns out to have this genius for training these troops. But if you were going to choose the guy to retrain your troops, I mean, a guy who from Prussia with a sketchy backstory who doesn't speak English does not seem like, you know, the person you would hire. But he turned out like there was just, I mean, even in his own training, he writes the training manual that is used in the army through the War of 1812. And there are still parts of the United States Army training manual that this guy wrote. And I think he says, I can't remember how he puts it, but he's talking about commanding officers and how they're not all suited for specific tasks, and like they're people with, you know, faults. And so many of the people on the American side especially do not seem like the person the hiring committee would hire, the voters would vote for. You know, they're just impossible choices. I mean, kind of my favorite was the bookstore owner Henry Knox, who becomes the chief artillery officer in the Continental Army, and he rises through the ranks because during the siege of Boston, there's a stalemate, and it turns out that there are a bunch of cannons and mortars and howitzers at Fort Ticonderoga, which is 300 miles away, over the Berkshire Mountains, and it's winter. And this guy who owns a bookstore goes up to Washington and says, I'll go get that stuff. Washington's like, sure, try it, you know. And then this guy, a few weeks later, comes back. He's built all these custom sleds. They pulled tons and tons of heavy artillery over the mountains to Boston. In the middle of the night, they haul it up onto Dorchester Heights, and the British, who are ensconced in Boston itself, wake up the next morning with all these cannons pointing down at them, and they sail away to Canada. And it's this big victory, and Henry Knox, who knows everything he knows because he's read military books that he used to sell in his bookstore, and he rises to be the head of the American artillery. So, I mean, it's really, in some ways, depressing if you think about trying to make a choice, you know, like in at your polling booth or in your company's HR department or something. Like, generally, the person who seems like the right person for the job is maybe not necessarily the right person for the job. I think we've all had those coworkers, you know.
When in doubt, vote for the bookseller.
It's true.
I have one more question about Lafayette, and then I have three questions from Twitter. And then we're going to open it up
Twitter.
To you people. Lafayette was injured at Brandywine on a September 11th, not the September 11th. Tell us about the monument to him there and what it meant historically and what it was like when you visited it more recently.
There's a monument to Lafayette near the place where he got shot, and it was put up in, I think, 1895, and which, you know, he had been dead for about six decades when it went up, and it's out in the middle of nowhere in the by the side of a road in rural Pennsylvania, and when they had this dedication, 5,000 people showed up to celebrate this really dinky monument, and it kind of speaks to his ongoing popularity, I think, decades and decades after the war. I mean, when I went there, it's part of this lady's yard. And, you know, I mean, I'm talking to her, like, I'm standing in her yard taking notes, so she comes out to say hi and see what's up, and we start talking about how, like, imagining 5,000 people coming to her yard, you know, to celebrate a thing that my driver drove by three times because it looks like a lamp post, you know? And how that speaks to the affection for him, I think. And but also, I mean, when they had the dedication ceremony, one of the people spoke about how, I mean, the place itself is a country road in Pennsylvania. It's all rolling hills and trees and green expanses, and it's and I think one of the men who dedicated the statue is like, you could never tell that here in this bucolic place was war, terrible war, you know. Like, you wouldn't know it if there wasn't that monument. So they put one up to, you know, remind people to feel bad.
Someone named Girl Wearing Socks, I hope she's wearing shoes too, has this question. I once heard an academic historian on a podcast say historians have to have a high tolerance for boredom. Do you believe this to be true? If so,
yes.
Have you ever abandoned any research topics that did not hold your interest?
Oh, I mean, yeah, it takes a certain amount of stamina. Like, oh, I remember in one of my books there was a section on President Garfield because he was, you know, murdered. And for that, I had to read his diaries. There are four volumes of them. Like, the four volume, it was almost a foot thick, printed, you know, and I think I got one or two things I could use out of that. And it took me forever to read these diaries, and they were so boring. But then, I mean, some of that, there wasn't a lot to grasp onto with him as a person because he was not scintillating, you know. But reading his diaries, you can only find this through, like, quantity time, but the only times he would perk up were about books. Like, he would sneak off from when he was in the House of Representatives, he would sneak off to the Library of Congress to read Jane Austen. Or there was this one day when he was really excited because his shipment had come in of the complete works of Goethe.
Wow.
And then I found this commencement address he had given at his old college. And it was basically where he tells these boys who are graduating, even if you find the life you want and, you know, you have the job you want and you have the family you want, etc., like, all of this stuff is really going to cut into your free time. And so at least I found this one thing, like, kind of his vice, like, he wanted to be reading, you know. I wrote a book about missionaries to Hawaii, and I can't tell you how many missionary letters I had to read. And they're not all fascinating, you know. Sometimes it's like, hey, can you pick me up some gloves the next time you're in Honolulu? You know, you do have to sift. There's a lot of sifting. But, I mean, once you, like, find the thing, I mean, it's essentially worth it. But I sift through that stuff for you, so you do not have to.
Thank you, Sarah.
You're welcome. I mean, and as for have I ever quit, yeah, I mean, it's not that I usually quit so much for being bored. It's like one time I was working on a book about Kansas in the 1850s, the whole Bleeding Kansas era. And there's a lot of drama there and some great characters. You know, you have John Brown and William Quantrill and Lawrence gets burned down and there's action. But then I realized that the question of that whole time period, the question was, should there be slavery in the West? And once I realized that was the question, I felt like we had answered that. And then I lost interest, you know.
Someone wants to know if you've seen the hip-hop musical Hamilton and what you think of it.
The hip-hop musical Hamilton about a Secretary of the Treasury. Yes, I have seen it. It is actually wonderful. I know, like, that idea just sells itself anyway. I mean, I like the back. I mean, it's a wonderful musical. It's one of the most dramatic and passionate and entertaining and funny and fun musicals I can think of. I mean, the only thing that has come close, I think, in my lifetime is maybe the Book of Mormon for, you know, just the sheer technical bravado of it and the story itself and the amount of heart and feeling and thought behind it. But I do like, the origin of it was that the creator read a biography of Alexander Hamilton, and he saw the character of Hamilton as a hip-hop story because he was an immigrant from the Caribbean who came to New York and made good. And that music really propels the story and is kind of integral to the feeling of that. And it's, I think, it's the feeling that most people in America, you know, come from some backstory like that. And the just aesthetics of it definitely jibe.
Last question, and then we'll open it up to the audience. Levi Hastings on Twitter says, someone needs to address the severe lack of Revolutionary War homoerotica in modern culture. I don't know if you're steeped
so
in gay
true.
Erotica, but where can Levi find some Revolutionary War homoerotica?
It's Dan Savage here. I feel like he could answer that better than me. Revolutionary War homoerotica. There are a lot of questions about some of them because they were so affectionate, and their letters are affectionate, and there are questions about maybe Hamilton and John Lawrence. There are questions about von Steuben. And I mean, it's a bunch of guys packed together in close quarters. And I feel like that setting lends itself to those stories, perhaps. I don't know where one would look for them. I mean, if he wanted to know, like, where to look for, say, compendia of about the French foreign policy and the diplomatic correspondence amongst the, you know, French ambassadors and the court of Louis the 16th, I could point him to some books. But what he's talking about was maybe a little more. I think he's more interested in like the free time.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, the leisure time activities. And I was more focused on, like, the day jobs.
Right. All right, let's open it up to the audience. Just raise your hand if you have a question.
And there's our friend there with the microphone. Let's see.
Oh, sorry. Yes, actually, move to the microphone if you have a question. That would be way better.
Would it, though?
I think so, don't you think?
Well, here, let's... Okay, well, that guy's going, so... Yeah. Hello.
Hey. Hello. Hey, good to meet you. Thanks a lot. Hey, can you, in your book or in your research, can you shed some light on what did the British really think of George Washington, and what did George Washington really think of his highfalutin foes on the other side, the Redcoats?
There is actually a lot of mutual respect there, and I think for good reason. When there was an American painter who was tasked with painting a portrait of George III toward the end of the war, and, you know, Washington famously at the end of the war went back home to Mount Vernon and did not become a new king or a new dictator. He just wanted to go home. And George III heard that and said something like, if he did that, he will be the greatest man alive. You know, just the idea of bringing that war to fruition and the amount of, you know, affection that the people had for him and the amount of gratitude that he shirked the power to just go home was, to George III, a testament to Washington's Republican ideals, I think. And then, you know, Washington obviously has a lot of respect for the British commanders who are kicking his ass. You know, I think there was generally mutual respect on both sides. I think maybe for some of the enlisted men, less so. I mean, when the British have to surrender to the Americans and the French at Yorktown, they come in a line to turn over their weapons, and the British were not looking. The Americans and the French were on either side of them, and the British soldiers would not look at the Americans. They would only look at the French, because the French were, you know, a proper army. And when that happened, Lafayette got really upset, and so he had his guys strike up Yankee Doodle really loud as a way of like, hey, look over here! And they do, you know. So I think the leadership on both sides, there was some mutual respect. I mean, there's certainly in all the records, like when that, like the Siege of Boston, when Henry Knox brings the heavy artillery back to Boston, and then the British wake up and they see all these cannons pointing down at them, and one of the British commanders, I think it might have been William Howe, was like, these guys have done more work in one night than my guys have done in one month. And, you know, another one of them is saying that this continent will not be quelled easily. So I think, I don't know, they sort of liked each other. If you're interested in the British leadership, I think one person I talked to in my book, whose book I loved, was Andrew Jackson O'Shaughnessy, who wrote a book called The Men Who Lost America. And it's a very measured, compassionate telling of the British commanders and some of the bureaucrats back home. And I think the way he speaks to their weaknesses, but also their strength, it makes Washington and his commander's achievements all the more remarkable, because these weren't knuckleheads they were up against. They were up against experienced military geniuses in some case.
We have time for three more questions.
Yes, sir.
One of my daughters, along with my favorite sort of side characters in your book, is your nephew Owen,
mm-hmm.
who you once described as the most Hitchcockian preschooler you had ever known.
He did have a bit of a dark side. Yeah.
I think you said he knew 90 words and one of them was crit.
Yeah.
So with Halloween just around the corner, can you bring us up to date on Owen?
Do I do what?
Just bring us up to date on Owen.
Oh, bring us up to date. He's 15. It's a real cute age. I believe he's going to be Marty McFly for Halloween. What else? He's a rather accomplished young thespian. He's right now in rehearsals for The Music Man. And he goes with me to some of the battlefields and Colonial Williamsburg and Monticello. It happened to be he was being homeschooled that year, so we did his American History unit on the road researching this book. And he really fell in love with Colonial Williamsburg, and it was really remarkable to watch him kind of light up being there. I think because he's a theater guy, and we bought him a costume and a tri-cornered hat, and he just fanned out and tried to blend in with the reenactors. And he really, he just so took to the story and was so enthralled with that time and place. And, you know, then he was saying things at dinner like, I think my favorite general is Nathaniel Greene, you know. And I was very grateful to, especially to Colonial Williamsburg, as a place that kind of reignited his interest in history. Because, I mean, he used to be kind of interested in it, and then came the video games, you know. So it was nice to see him kind of just fall in love with that place. Yes?
Hi. So for a lot of American history, it's hard to talk about women because there's not a lot of recorded history and the education of women is not prioritized. But I know that during the Revolutionary War, there were a number of women who were integral to the war effort. And in fact, before Paul Revere did his midnight ride, there was a woman who went and rallied the Minutemen in her village.
I saw that episode of Drunk History,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, it was amazing, right? Yeah.
Uh-huh. Oh, your question is just talk about the women?
Yeah, like what role would that be, and why don't we learn about it?
Why were there what? What was the last part?
Why don't we learn about it? How can we learn about it?
Oh, I mean, it's a big war, and there are a lot of fascinating people, and it's a generation where it's kind of hard to shine in that generation because it's such a remarkable collection, you know, with, you know, John Adams and Washington and Jefferson and Madison and, you know, like, I mean, the fact that Hamilton gets his own musical, he's just such a, like, the B-side, you know, and he's amazing. I mean, he's like a really key figure in history. They're just, it's one of those periods where I guess maybe the Civil War is a little bit like that, where there are just so many accomplished individuals. There were some women who pretended to be men and fought in the war. I mean, I spend a lot of time on this tangent because I went to the reenactment of the Battle of Brandywine. And I get really transfixed watching this female reenactor sit in the grass winding yarn. And it sort of like reminded me of how maybe in a lot of ways the women are kind of marginalized in the, you know, actual battles. And my story is about a soldier, so I do focus on that. But the the revolution has been going on for 10 years before shots are fired. And in that 10 years between the Stamp Act and the shots fired at Lexington, the women are integral to the integral to the resistance against the British, because a lot of that resistance has to do with shopping. You know, a lot of it has to do with boycotts and boycotting British goods that are being unfairly taxed, and especially cloth. And the colonial women basically start the homespun movement, where they make their own cloth. And it comes to represent not just handiwork, it kind of, that word comes to mean what it means to us, this American way of life, this really rustic, self-reliant way of living, and not just arts and crafts, you know. And it kind of culminates in Washington being inaugurated as president wearing his homespun wool suit. And, I mean, I also mentioned how, especially in the years of the boycotts, like tea, for example, you know, there are those guys who get all the attention for dressing up like Indians and throwing the tea off the wharf in Boston Harbor. But a lot of people, women especially, how they protested that tax was they stopped drinking tea. And the women... And I was thinking about what that must have meant to have to, I mean, they had really hard lives. They had to make their own cloth. They had to take care of the children and the livestock and grow food and cook and all the household stuff. And they're doing it without caffeine, you know? And they don't get any credit for that. But they're doing this for years, and you know, and they have little tricks like boiling basil and water to have something hot to drink, but really, I mean, it takes, some of this stuff is just like, I'm going to do without, you know? And so, yeah, they're not really fighting, but, I mean, I do have little moments where some of these major or fairly major figures leave, like Washington writes Martha the letter, like, sorry, honey, I'm not coming home. And Lafayette abandons his pregnant teenage wife to come to America. And Silas Deane, who's one of the envoys that the Continental Congress sends to Paris, who works with Ben Franklin to lobby the French government, he sends his wife a letter when he's going to France. And he's already left her at home in Connecticut for him to go to Philadelphia. And he's left her to take care of his son, who is the son of his dead wife before her. And he sends her this letter like, sorry, I'm not coming home. Take care of the kid. I really wish I could be there with you. But, you know, and he never sees her again. And he leaves her to take care of this kid who isn't, you know, her flesh and blood. And, like, that is a pretty common predicament. And... you know, I mean, I think I say in there, history might be full of great fathers, but recorded history is maybe not where to go looking for them, you know? I mean, so... yeah, but, I mean, kind of to me, one of the most bittersweet parts of the research, and I quote from a few of these letters... the letters between Abigail Adams and John Adams, clearly she's the brains of the outfit. And she, I mean, you read her letters and you think, obviously she should have been one of the presidents, you know, and she's not. And I'm not going to pretend she was more important than she was, but the fact that she wasn't allowed to become more important than she was is kind of tragic. So... use that frustration and do something.
All right, the last two questions right there.
Hi.
Hi. So I understand Lafayette visited his uncle in London prior to coming to America, and that when he was there, he met a bunch of important Brits, including Lord Sackville, the Secretary of State for the Americas.
Mm-hmm.
And then he came to America to fight against them. Did you find any writing of his about that trip? Because
just knowing
that basic little bit, it sounds like he was sizing them up. I'm just curious if he wrote anything about them. You speak very highly of them, but
what he's talking about is right before Lafayette goes to the United States, he had a previous scheduled trip to London to visit his wife's uncle, who was the ambassador, the French ambassador to Great Britain. And because this guy's the ambassador to Great Britain, he introduces Lafayette around to a lot of highfalutin Brits, including Henry Clinton, who was eventually the commander-in-chief of the British armies, and also King George III. And Lafayette is planning his escape to America at that time. And so it's a pretty bratty thing to do to his uncle, the ambassador, to be like, how are you doing, King George? You know, and then 2 weeks later, he's like trying to get to America. And he does write in his memoirs, I can't remember exactly how he put it, like he blamed it. He admitted it was a pretty bratty, youthful thing to do, and his uncle-in-law was really embarrassed by this. So he does write about it a little bit. Yeah. I mean, he was a teenage boy. It's hard to keep track of all the bratty stuff he's doing. That's definitely one of them. He definitely gets less. Well, he's still in France, and then he goes to England, and then he goes back to France and, like, hightails it to America. There's a lot of bratty stuff going on, like, most notably abandoning his pregnant wife. But then something kind of happens to him when he gets to America, and he sort of, like, mans up a little bit, you know, and becomes more humble and hardworking and dedicated and reliable and sweet-tempered. Yes?
Hi.
Sorry.
I just wanted to say that your audiobooks are absolutely wonderful. And
thank you.
That's actually how I first was introduced to your writing, is a friend of mine led me Assassination Vacation,
uh-huh.
And I would fall asleep listening to it every night.
That good, huh?
But in like a night, no, that
no,
came out
No, I know
wrong.
What you mean.
Yes,
I used to do that when I was a teenage trumpet player with Louis Armstrong.
Yes, you are my
it's
Louis
nice
Armstrong.
It's nice that I can be someone's Louis Armstrong in that way. And not the way I intended, which was to be a great trumpet player.
Well, my question about that is, what is the process of creating the audiobooks in terms of, like, casting the voices and how that happens? But also, John Ronson's book, Lost at Sea, is dedicated to you. Could you maybe say why?
Why John Ronson dedicated a book to me? That is a good question. I'm always nice to John Ronson. I think like he and I actually do have a certain kinship with our writing. I probably think of him as kind of the writer who is most like me in a lot of ways, because he takes on really serious topics like terrorism or mental illness or you know, his last book was on public shaming and stuff. And he takes on these serious topics and he does a lot of research, and there's a lot of like shoe leather in those books, but then he does have a kind of playful side. I mean, as for the audiobooks, I work really hard on those. I mean, a lot of it is just scheduling. I mean, more and more, when I do those, I basically rewrite the book to accommodate the actors who are doing the historical voices. I mean, just in like minor ways, instead of, you know, introduce like a sentence that says, XYZ said Lafayette, JKL. You know, like I would write that so it says Lafayette said XYZ, blah, blah, blah. So it's actually really tedious. And then picking the actors and stuff, I mean, a lot of that is just who'll do it, who's available, who's around. And then sometimes, though, that is, I really like that part of the process to, like, listen to them do their parts because, like in this one, I have Fred Armisen as Lafayette's wife and some other characters. But it was fascinating to watch, to listen to how he does his job, you know. And so for some of the foreign accents, I think he has to do French, German, and, yeah, French and Germans. He, and maybe a Swede. Before he starts in a new accent, it's like he writes a little play in his mind that he, like, he has some character. It seems to me they're always, like, some rock and roll band from that country is having an argument. And then, like, a French rock and roll band is having an argument, and then he records a French lady. You know, it's really interesting. Or, like... just to, I mean, one time, I mean, I had been doing it for a while. I think I just started doing that, honestly, because the first time I was making one of those, they said, this is going to be 7 hours long. And that's a lot of me to listen to, you know? And I thought, I should break this up with some other people. And that was all I thought about. And then I also thought, honestly, that first one I made, that one of the characters was my friend Kevin, and I had just been corresponding with Norman Lear because he owns a Declaration of Independence, and I just pictured the cover that like listed a bunch of names, and then it said, and Norman Lear as Kevin, and that came true. That came true. Norman Lear was my friend Kevin, but then like a couple of books later, John Slattery came in, John Slattery from Mad Men, and he was reading, it was for my Puritans book, and he was reading, there's a little coda at the end about this speech JFK gives right before his inauguration to the Massachusetts legislature, and Slattery was reading that speech as JFK, and I mean, I was so kind of mesmerized by the way he was saying this speech, and conveying the meaning of it, I just thought, this guy is helping me tell this story. And when you're writing a book, no one's helping you. You know, you're by yourself. I mean, some people, like, give you advice, and they'll let you interview them, but when you're, like, writing a book, you're in a room by yourself for, like, months, a year, and it feels like you're on your own. And like, the first time I heard him do it, and he was, he was giving that speech, and I really believed what he was saying to the extent that I was learning new things about the speech, even though the book was already written. So, sometimes, those things, they do, like, there's more meaning, or maybe just more emotional manipulation that comes from acting or whatever. But for whatever reason, having someone be those voices sometimes is just nice, hearing these people who have been voices in my head, just hearing them come to life.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Christopher.
Coming to life, a voice in our head here in our town. Sarah's signing books in the back. Please give it up one more time for her.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this podcast of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. If you like what you heard, you might leave a good review. It helps other listeners find us. Sarah Vowell's appearance at the Neptune Theater on October 28, 2015 was hosted by Seattle Theater Group and the Elliott Bay Book Company. Thank you again to Anna Tadashev for our recording. Tune in next week for another great talk. For Speakers Forum, KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien.